All right, so the recorder's on. So this is Bio 241, the Monday-Wednesday section, and it is Wednesday, January 21st. All right, our only lecture for this whole week. So we're sort of in the middle of the chemistry chapter. Oh, you did see it. It was up there. Sorry, I thought it was not on the screen. There it is. And let's see. I had a thought. Okay, I forgot what the thought is. It might come back to me. But anyway, let's review a little bit. Chemical bonds. You should know some chemical bonds by name. Can anybody give me a name of a chemical bond?
Covalent.
What's another one?
Ionic.
And what's another one?
Hydrogen
bond. And you should be able to rank in order of strength what these chemical bonds are. What's the strongest?
Covalent.
What's the weakest?
Hydrogen.
And what's in between? An ionic bond, right? And so you should know why they form, and that allows these different bonds, the forming and breaking of chemical bonds is really chemistry. So chemistry is the reactions that compounds undergo, and that is due to the breaking and making of these chemical bonds. So if you're going to think of chemistry or making and breaking chemical bonds, what part of the atom, what element of the atom are we most interested in? So what are the pieces that make up an atom?
Protons,
neutrons, electrons. Where do you find a proton? Where do you find a neutron? And where do you find electrons? In shells, or you could say orbitals too. Okay. Which one of those things are most important for understanding chemistry? Electrons, and in particular, which ones? The valence electrons, the electrons that are in the outermost shell. Okay, we learned rules for how you fill the shells up. First shell, how many electrons can you put in the first shell? Only two. In the second shell?
Eight.
And you can see that if you just look at the periodic table, which I'll give you for the first test, you see that structure. All right, so the first shell corresponds to this first row on the periodic table, and indeed you see how many elements right there? There's two, so there are two electrons that go in the first shell, right? The second row, there are eight, right? So that determines how many electrons can go in the second shell. So you don't have to memorize those rules because you'll have the periodic table as long as you know how to read it. And furthermore, what makes one element different from another element? That's, it's close, but that might lead you astray. The number of protons inside, of course you know they're in the nucleus now. And what do we call that number?
Atomic number.
Yeah, the atomic number. And as you can see, the atomic number is written down on each one of these elements here in the periodic table. And you have to know some names of elements by their chemical symbol. For instance, an easy one. I'll tell you on the test, what's the atomic number for carbon? Okay, the atomic number for carbon. Its symbol for sure is C, which is not a given because C could stand for copper, right? It could stand for cobalt or it could stand for carbon, but C really is carbon, right? So then you'd find C over here and you say, oh, well, the atomic number is 6. You don't have to memorize the atomic number, but what you do have to memorize is the English name for the Greek symbol, right? Because Na stands for sodium. That comes from the Greek word natrium, all right? You don't have to know what language it comes from, but you got to know Na is sodium, K is potassium, and is iron I?
No,
what's I? Yeah, I is iodine. I is not Fe. Somebody's trying to trick me. Okay, and then atomic number. And then by the number of protons the nucleus has, that determines how many electrons are in the shells, and then you fill the shells up, and to be stable, all the shell should be filled up, the valence shell should be filled up maximally with electrons. That determines if a compound is going to be an ion or not. Okay, and then you learn some rules about naming ions. What's a positive ion?
Cation.
What's a negative ion?
Anion.
Oh, what is an ion? What the heck is an ion? I would say, I don't like the neutron theory for explaining what an ion is. What's the charge on a neutron?
It
has no charge. So by the basic nature of a neutron, it could never participate in making anything ionic. Because what an ion is means you got to have some kind of charge. You got to have some kind of electrical charge. So either due to an excess of protons or an excess of electrons. So an ion is an atom or a molecule that has an electrical charge on it. Okay. I think we talked about pH. pH is a measure of something. What's pH a measure of? Yeah, it's a measure of acidity, which is really the measure of the hydrogen ion concentration. And as the hydrogen ion concentration goes up, what happens to acidity? That's a tricky kind of question. Okay. But as the hydrogen ion concentration goes up, the solution becomes more acidic. All right, more hydrogen ions, more acidity. But what about the pH number? Yeah, as the hydrogen ion concentration goes up, the pH number goes down. All right, so that's the inverse relationship. There's a direct relationship between acidity and hydrogen ions, but the pH number and hydrogen ion concentration has an inverse relationship. Okay. So I think we talked about all that kind of stuff. The pH scale. Maybe there's a switch I didn't flip. Ah, good. That's easy to fix. All right. The pH scale goes from what two numbers? 0 to 14. Did we talk about that last time? No? Ah, okay. I hear yes and no, but let's say no. Okay. Well, then you're having a hard time answering my previous questions, too. Okay, about acidity. So let me start right here. We're talking about pH. All right, so what the heck is an acid? What the heck is a base? Let's start with looking at your periodic table. And I think I remember doing this last time. Ooh, that's a really lousy marker. I thought it worked better. All right, here we have... That looks like red now. Okay. Here's a proton inside the nucleus. Here's an electron outside in this orbital. What element is this?
Hydrogen.
Hydrogen. And how would you know?
One.
Yeah, because you got the periodic table right there. You know how to use the atomic number and all that kind of stuff. All right, so that's a hydrogen atom. And if we modify this hydrogen atom by taking away this electron, what is that thing? That's a hydrogen ion. It's got another name. Hydrogen ion. It's an ion because now it has a charge on it, a 1 plus charge, but it has another name. You know the name of that thing. That is a? That's just a plain old proton. So a hydrogen ion and a proton are exactly the same thing. We use those two names interchangeably. So you just got to kind of get used to it. A lot of times students don't like to hear this term proton for some reason. Well, because you've never seen one. Never shot any pool with it or anything. But so a proton is just a hydrogen atom that has lost its electron. Okay, so an acid is something that generates this thing when you put that chemical into solution. For instance, like hydrochloric acid. It's an acid because when you put HCl into water, this completely dissociates and it produces two ions. So HCl, when we put it in water, produces hydrogen ions plus chloride ions, just like that. And these dissolve in water because why? Hydration spheres can form around these ions because water is a polar compound. Is that kind of ringing a bell? Yeah? And so these two compounds will dissolve into water and the hydrogen ion concentration goes up. The solution becomes more acidic. What happens to the pH number? Okay, we'll have to say this a couple times. It goes down. All right, so the same for all of these things. Phosphoric acid, nitric acid, sulfuric acid. None of these are too important for biology, but carbonic acid is. When you put this thing in water, these hydrogens can disassociate from the carbonate part, and that increases the hydrogen ion concentration of that solution, which increases the acidity, which decreases the pH number. And you're kind of familiar with this because there is a compound that your body produces all the time, not exactly in this form, but a similar form, and you breathe it out of your body. What waste gas, what waste material do you breathe out of your body?
Carbon
dioxide. Carbon dioxide is related to carbonic acid. It can be interconverted. So your body produces carbonic acid because it's producing CO2. Okay. All right, so an acid releases protons in a solution. We sometimes call that a proton donor. It can donate protons to a solution, or it can donate hydrogen ions to a solution. A base, on the other hand, will lower hydrogen ion levels when that molecule is placed into solution. Sometimes we say it is a proton acceptor. So for instance, if we put hydrochloric acid in water, all right, and then let's look at, what do we have right there? Sodium hydroxide and AOH. This will completely dissociate into hydroxide plus sodium. Right, and this will dissolve in water because sodium can form hydration spheres. Right, this anion can dissolve in water because it has that charge and it can form hydration spheres. All right, so what is the net result when we put an acid and a base together? Okay, and if we add them together in just the equal quantities, right, we can have a hydrogen ion and a hydroxide anion. What is this going to form? H2O. Water. So acids and bases will neutralize each other and form water as a result. So that's why we say a base can lower a hydrogen ion level, right? Because it can combine with a hydrogen to form water to neutralize that solution. So we say a base is a proton acceptor as a result of that. Okay, I don't see any really important biological bases. Ammonium hydroxide. Okay, or ammonia is. All right, but we're going to be familiar with this carbonic acid one. All right, so how does this relate to pH scale? All right, pH is just a measure of the hydrogen ion concentration. All right, and hydrogen ion concentration, we can abbreviate, what is this thing that's hydrogen ion? Instead of writing concentration all the time, or proton, right, or proton concentration. If we put brackets around it, these brackets mean the concentration of that particular molecule in solution in terms of a molar concentration. And for instance, it could be 0.1 molar. It could be 0.01 molar. It could be 0.001 molar. Which one of these is the smallest? This is the first, second, or third, the smallest concentration. Yeah, it's 1,000 times, it's 100 times smaller than the 0.1. Okay? So this is the concentration of hydrogen ions. All right? And when we take the pH of something, we use the equation that you see on this board right here. All right? And so we just take the log of 1 over the hydrogen ion concentration. So pH, let me say this. This is going to be an important relationship. Maybe you guys know this already. All right, let's just say X is equal to Y. How is Y related to X? Did I show you this last time? I don't think so. We just say Y is directly related to X. Because what happens to X if Y increases? If Y increases, what happens to X? It increases too, right? So we say directly related. So we're going to use this explanation a lot in this class, but we could also say X is equal to 1 over Y. So when Y gets big, what happens to X? It doesn't get big, it goes the opposite way. When Y gets big, X gets small. We say inversely related. Okay, so for instance, to use those terms, we could say, how is the amount of time that you study related usually to the grade that you get in a class? Is directly related. Not always the case, but hopefully, if you study right, it is. Okay? I don't have on the tip of my tongue a good example of what's inversely related. Okay? Except for pH. This is a good example. You can see what? That the pH, okay, with the equal sign, we have hydrogen ion concentration in the denominator right here, so that when the hydrogen ion concentration goes up, what happens to the pH number? It goes down. Okay, so let's get back to this annotation over here. All right, so this is the same thing as saying 1 times 10 to the minus 1 power in scientific notation. This is 1 times 10 to the minus 2. This is 1 times 10 to the minus 3. That just represents the number of decimal places that you have to move over to get a 1 over here. Okay, so what pH is really just this number right here. If we put it into that formula, it's just the exponent. Okay, so the pH for 0.1 would be 1. The pH for a concentration of 0.01 would be 2. And the pH number for a concentration of hydrogen ions, 0.001, would be 3. So can you see as the concentration decreases, right? This is a much smaller number. What happens to the pH number? It gets bigger. Or as something has more hydrogen ions, what happens to the pH number? It gets smaller. Right? If you want to run a bunch of numbers through that equation right there, you can to kind of prove that to yourself. But that's how it goes. So there is an inverse relationship between pH and hydrogen ion concentration. There's a direct relationship between hydrogen ion concentration and acidity. So you've got to somehow be familiar with that. It'll all be really easy, second nature to you soon. Okay, but don't get tricked by that. So the pH scale goes between 0 and 14. You know what the number is right in the middle of 0 and 14? That's going to be 7. Yeah? Okay, that's 7. And at a pH of 7, that means that the hydrogen ion concentration is equal to the hydroxide concentration. And if they're equal, that means what? They cancel out. That's a neutral solution. So that's pH 7. It's neither acidic nor basic solution. And as this pH number gets smaller, what about the hydrogen ion concentration? It goes up. Okay? And as the hydrogen ion concentration goes down, the pH number gets bigger. Okay? And if the concentrations are equal, the pH is 7. So we say pH 7 is neutral. Neither acidic or basic. So that's what it says on this slide right here. So what about our physiology? What kind of pH are we inside our bodies? Are we neutral? We're close. 7.4. Okay, we're kind of at a range between, I don't know if I have it on a slide or not, between 7.35. Okay, 7.35 and 7.45, so 7.4. So our bodies are what? A little acidic or a little basic? As the number gets bigger than 7, it becomes more basic. Right, so we're a little alkaline or basic inside our bodies. It's on the next slide. Good. All right, so I'm going to go back to this. So this is actually what I was putting on the board right here. At pH 7, notice that the concentration of hydrogen ions is 1 times 10 to the minus 7, and the concentration of hydroxide ions is 1 times 10 to the minus 7, equal to each other. So they kind of balance each other out. As one increases, the other decreases. Right, as the other increases, the other decreases. And the pH number is just really handy because who wants to write 1 times 10 to the minus 14? Or who wants to write 1 with 14 zeros after it? It's much easier to say, oh, pH 0. So what's your impression of pH 0? Is that acidic or basic?
Acidic.
Very acidic, right. Okay, so I think you're kind of getting a feel for pH. All right, well, there are times when we eat acids, right? Or we eat bases. And our bodies really can't tolerate a change in pH. Homeostasis has to be maintained for pH. A pretty good example of this. Let's just say your body right now is healthy. You're at a pH of 7.4. And all of a sudden you drink a quart of acid, which some of us like to do. What kind of thing do we drink that's very acidic? Coca-Cola. 7-Up might be acidic because there's citric acid in 7-Up and things like that. But Coke is even more acidic. It's about a pH of 1. It's extremely acidic. All right, so that's going to change your pH. And if your pH were to change suddenly from 7.4, say, to 7.2, does that seem like a big change in terms of a pH number? 0.4 to 0.2? Some people that actually have a little medical background say, well, that's a pretty big change. But people that are just thinking about pH initially will say, well, there's really not much difference between, well, say you have $7.40 in your pocket or $7.20. Is that like a big deal? That's not a big deal. But in terms of pH, guess what? If you were to drink that Coke and your pH went from 7.4 to 7.2, that'd probably be fatal if that happened in a matter of just a couple minutes. Maybe over a long period of time, your body could adjust. Maybe if you had diabetes or something and you went into that condition over a period of months or a year or weeks, your body can compensate. But quickly, that would be fatal, right? So how is it that you can drink a quart of acid like Coca-Cola and still maintain pH and still live? And that is because there are chemical compounds in your body that will take all of those hydrogen ions that you're ingesting and get rid of them for you. Those are called buffers. So a buffer is a chemical compound that will resist the change in pH in your body by either getting rid of hydrogen ions that you're eating or even hydroxide ions that you're eating. A buffer will resist the change in pH. A buffer won't maintain, I've heard this a lot from students, a buffer won't maintain neutrality. It will just maintain whatever pH that buffer is designed to work at. All right, so maybe some buffers work at pH 8. You can add an acid to that system. The pH will stay 8. Right? A buffer is not going to make it go to 7. A buffer is going to maintain whatever that pH is, whether you add an acid or a base to that solution. And guess what we are? We're a solution, right? Not necessarily a solution to a problem, but a solution made up of water and a bunch of chemicals dumped inside of it. Okay, and one important buffer system is this bicarbonate buffer system. You've seen carbonic acid before on one of the previous slides, and carbonic acid can undergo some chemical reactions, right? You see that water and carbon dioxide can combine. These are what we call reactants, can form a product, carbonic acid. Okay, so you see we have two oxygens here and an oxygen here in water, so we end up with three oxygens right here. Did you guys talk about that today in lab?
A little bit.
It's one of the kind of laws of thermodynamics. Okay. That elements can neither be created nor destroyed through chemical reactions. They can just be rearranged. Right? So if we have a carbon here, there's got to be only one carbon over here on this side of the equation. All right, so we rearrange these molecules and make carbonic acid, and then that can further dissociate into bicarbonate ion and hydrogen ion right here. So for instance, if we have this buffer system in our body like we do, if we eat acid, right, that acid, that hydrogen ion will combine with bicarbonate, produce carbonic acid, and when it gets to your lungs, that's going to produce CO2, and you'll just breathe that acid right out of your body. And that will maintain the hydrogen ion concentration at its proper level. All right, so a buffer, and we're going to talk about this principle, how things can go back and forth through a series of chemical reactions in a little bit. Notice that, what can you tell me about this arrow right here? Is it pointing one way or is it pointing two ways? It's what we call bidirectional. So these chemicals can freely interconvert with each other. And, well, I guess maybe I'll tell you this. This is what we call the law of mass action, or Le Chatelier's principle. And that is, it's a law that says when you have a bidirectional reaction, if a reaction can go back and forth, if we put in one reactant, it's going to force the reaction, okay, in the other direction. So if we add hydrogen ions to this chemical reaction, it's going to force it to go to the left. If we add a lot of CO2, what's going to happen to this reaction? It's going to force it over to the right, right? Or if we take out hydrogen ions, this reaction is going to be forced to the right to bring hydrogen ion concentration back to its equilibrium value. All right, so that when we eat a lot of acid, this reaction is going to be forced to the left, and we're just going to be breathing out a lot of CO2. So actually, when we breathe stuff out of our bodies, we're actually acting like a bunch of aliens on that spaceship, right? They had that alien blood that dripped on the spaceship and it ate it away. We're almost like that. We excrete a lot of acid from our body just by breathing out CO2. And where does the acid in CO2 come from? From carbonic acid, from this proton right here with this bicarbonate buffer system. Okay, so don't forget about these bidirectional arrows right here. All right, normal pH range is 7.35 to 4.5, so I guess you could say the set point is? What would be a set point here? Would be?
0.4.
Yeah, 0.4. You could just take the average of those two numbers, right? The normal range is 3.5 to 4.5, 7.35. The set point would be right smack in the middle. Okay, and it's maintained by various buffers in your body. There are other buffers besides bicarbonate. All proteins act as buffers. Who's heard of protein before? All right. Your body has a lot of proteins. What's a building block of a protein? We'll talk about that today. Amino acids, right? So all proteins are buffers. There's one important protein. People forget that it's a buffer. It's mucus. Usually you think mucus is for lubrication, but it is also a buffer because it's a protein. Acidosis is a condition when the pH of your body goes below 7.35. We could consider that a disease state. Alkalosis, on the other hand, occurs with a pH greater than 7.45. That's a disease state as well. And on this slide right here, maybe I'll just mention really quickly, when you hyperventilate, all right, and you could just do this for fun if you wanted to, just sitting at your desk right there, when you hyperventilate, what are you releasing from your body?
CO2.
What we say, blowing off CO2. You're getting rid of an excess amount of CO2 in your body. So when this chemical compound is decreased, what about that law of mass action and Le Chatelier's principle? What's going to take place in your body when we take a lot of CO2 out of it, an abnormal amount of CO2? Which way is this reaction going to go, to the right or to the left? It's going to go to the left because these chemicals are going to try to rebuild the concentration of CO2 up. All right, and what happens when you get rid of hydrogen ions inside your body? What happens to your pH? Does it go up or down, or does it stay the same? Okay, when you get rid of hydrogen ions, right, you're losing acid from your body, your pH goes up. What do we call an abnormally high pH in somebody? That is an? Okay, it's the opposite one. That's what we call an alkalosis. So just by hyperventilating, that can produce an alkalosis in somebody. And we would call that a respiratory alkalosis. All right, so just by hyperventilating, you can manipulate your pH according to this buffer system right here. Okay, because an alkalosis would be, but a pH higher than 7.45. When you hyperventilate, you're getting rid of this chemical compound, your pH will increase. That would have helped a lot in lab today. Oh, cool. Okay, well. All right. Does anybody have lab this afternoon, maybe? Okay. All right. All right, let's talk about so that's pH. So you got to look at that over the weekend. You know, it's kind of tricky as acidity goes up, the pH number goes down. Don't get tricked by that one. Who's got a question about pH? Anybody? I could give you one more example, but let's move on. You'd like another example to kind of see? Really quick. I'll do one more example, but as I'm erasing the board, I'm going to talk about what we're going to talk about next. Next, we're going to talk about important biological molecules in your body. Ooh, that's an important thing. Maybe I won't erase that. And biological molecules sometimes are organic molecules. And there's four important kinds of organic or biochemical molecules in your body. And then I'll do the pH example. You've got carbohydrates. What's another name for a carbohydrate? Nope, I don't like fats. Sugars are carbohydrates. And also saccharides are sugars. So sugars, carbohydrates, and saccharides are all the same thing. That's one class. Okay, there's another class. Somebody said lipids. That's another class, so that's two. There's another class called proteins. That's three. And then the fourth class, which we're going to talk about, are nucleic acids. That's four. So you got carbohydrates, proteins, lipids, nucleic acids. That's what we're going to talk about next. But first we're going to do One more example. I got a couple beakers right here, three beakers, and in this first beaker, can you see this? Sort of. Hydrogen ion, hydrogen ion, OH, 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 like this, okay. Here's a beaker. It's got this in it. And here's a beaker that looks like this. And I think this will be really clear after you, if you can see my drawing. Okay. So what can you tell me about the pH in beaker number one? You should even be able to tell me the number of this one. Okay. Oh, I'm sorry. Right here. Some people are saying 7. I like your answer. Why did you say 7? It's neutral. Okay. Why is it neutral? Because the number of hydrogen ions is equal to the hydroxide ions. So they neutralize each other. pH 7. All right. What about this beaker right here? You can't tell me the pH number of this one, right? But you could tell me if it's acidic or basic. Is it basic? Why is it basic? It's got more hydroxide ions in it, right? So the pH is going to be less than 7. You can at least say that in terms of the pH number. And what about greater than 7? Greater. Greater than 7. And this one here? Acidic. Yeah, this is acidic because as the hydrogen ion concentration increases, it becomes acidic, which means what? The pH number goes down. So that's got to be like this symbol. Less than 7. All right, so always just think of the hydrogen ion concentration, right? As it goes up, it becomes more acidic. This number gets smaller. Okay, so that's just what I wanted to show you. Okay, organic molecules. This is a good definition for an organic molecule. It's a molecule that contains both a carbon and a hydrogen atom bound together with a covalent bond, not hydrogen bond or ionic bond or anything like that. So, there are important biological molecules, like, for instance, we talked about CO2 already. Is that an organic molecule? It's important in your body. But let's look at that definition. What's an organic molecule? It's got to have C and H. This one here has C, but does it have H? No. This is an inorganic molecule, but your body produces it all the time, which is a good thing. Okay, what about water? Is water an important molecule for you? Absolutely. Is that an organic molecule? No, it's got an H, but it doesn't have carbon. That's an inorganic molecule. So whether it's important for your physiology or not doesn't determine whether it's organic or not. So we're going to talk about organic molecules, all right? And organic molecules have that carbon. What's the atomic number for carbon? 6. All right, so in the outer shell, how many electrons does it have? It's got 4 because the first shell's got 2. There's 4 electrons left over. So it wants to share 4 more electrons, maybe with 4 other atoms. And so it forms chemical bonds very nicely in a nice symmetrical kind of way. All right, so carbon has 4 electrons. Oh, it says right here. In the outer shell, bonds covalently fill the outer shell with 8 electrons to form chemical bonds. So here is a typical kind of organic molecule. We call this hexane, because it has 6 carbons, a nice long carbon backbone, and it's organic because it has both carbon and hydrogen. This is not an important biological molecule. It's actually very poisonous, but it is organic. Some people might use it recreationally, hopefully not, because it will dissolve your brain cells, but it will alter your reality for sure. Okay. Okay, so that's just an organic molecule. This can form a ring structure, and when it does, we call that cyclohexane. And so we would just draw it like this. But usually we wouldn't draw in all these hydrogen atoms associated with every carbon. We would just leave it off. We would just draw this thing that kind of looks like a stop sign right here. And we would know that at this point there are actually two hydrogens right here, but we don't have to draw it in. There's another form of cyclohexane where if we take away one of these hydrogen atoms, then there is an extra electron that can pair up. So here there's going to be a double bond between carbons. This is what we're going to call benzene. Again, that's a kind of dangerous compound. It's organic molecule, but it's not important biologically. All right, so the backbone for organic molecules is what? This nice long carbon chain. And off of these carbon atoms, we can put different kinds of elements or other kinds of functional groups. So here are some functional groups that we can add to this carbon backbone. And when you change the shape of a molecule, guess what you're changing? That's right. So you should always think, change in shape, change in function. If there's a change in function, you could probably guess what? There is a change in shape of something, right? There's always a structural functional relationship, even at the molecular level. So I'm going to have you memorize what these different functional groups are for a test. So this one, this carbon with a double bonded oxygen in the middle of the chain, we call that a carbonyl group. And if there is an OH, that's an hydroxyl group. Probably you're familiar with that already because that's how you make alcohols with this hydroxyl group on a very short two-carbon chain molecule. A sulfhydryl group has an SH. Amino group has an NH2. And a carboxyl group at the end of a long chain of carbon, you have a CO2 and an H. That's a carboxyl group. And for instance, this hydrogen right here can disassociate and join a solution. What do we call a compound that can donate a hydrogen ion to solution? That's an acid. So a carboxyl group is acidic. All right, so here this is an acid. And then here is a phosphate group. So a phosphate group is a PO4. Here's a phosphate with four oxygens on it. That's going to change the properties of this molecule. Now, some covalent bonds are nonpolar and some covalent bonds are polar. The bond between two carbons is nonpolar, and the bond between a carbon and a hydrogen is nonpolar. To form a polar bond, hydrogen has to be bound to an atom that pulls electrons away from the hydrogen. And I gave you a list. What kind of atoms that are greedy and they pull electrons away from hydrogen?
Oxygen,
oxygen, phosphorus,
nitrogen.
So look at what we have right here. We have this phosphorus that produces a very polar end to this molecule right here, which means what? This can dissolve in water, at least this end of the molecule. This carboxyl group, okay, makes this molecule able to dissolve in water, as opposed to, if we go back to this one, there's nothing polar about this molecule at all, right? It's just carbon hydrogen. This molecule can't dissolve in water. Doesn't have that possibility, right? So these, and here's that nitrogen, right? That's going to produce a polar covalent bond. That's going to allow this molecule to dissolve in water. So that's an important functional difference, and that's why I want you to know functional groups. Oh, what about this hydroxyl group right here? Is that going to form a polar or nonpolar? That's polar. Oxygen forms a polar. That's the basis of water, right? The oxygen in water is pulling electrons away from the hydrogens in water, producing a polar compound. So things that have hydroxyl functional groups on them have a tendency to dissolve in water just because it produces this polar kind of covalent bond. Okay, so that's pretty much it for functional groups. So let's look at some of those four basic kinds of compounds: sugars, lipids, proteins, nucleic acids, and analyze them a little bit for these things that we've been talking about already. So carbohydrates. Another name for a carbohydrate is two different names. What are the two different names? Sugars or saccharides, same thing. I don't know of any distinction between them. And what we see right here are some examples of carbohydrates or sugars or saccharides. And what you might notice is a nice long carbon backbone right here. And that backbone right there is nonpolar. It doesn't dissolve in water. But what can you tell me about sugar? Does it dissolve in water when you put sugar in your coffee? How would you explain that? Because, not because of the carbon backbone right here, but look at all these hydroxyl groups on it. These are forming polar covalent bonds with this hydrogen, and it's loaded with hydroxyl groups, so sugars dissolve very easily in water, no problem. Unlike benzene or hexane, which has no chance whatsoever. Right? And also this group here allows it to dissolve in water. It can form a ring structure just like this, and we would draw it with the oxygen right here. So if you ever see this little symbol right here, that would be a symbol for a sugar of some kind. And I want you to be able to recognize these as being sugars or carbohydrates or a saccharide. I don't want you to be able to tell me that this one is glucose or this one is galactose. It all depends on what side of the molecule this particular OH is on. See, it's on the other side over here, so it's a little bit different compound, so we give it a little bit different name. It's not important that you know that molecular structure at all, but what's important that you should know that this, by its structure, is a carbohydrate. So you might be wondering, how does a carbohydrate, how did it ever get its name? And it's pretty easy to see that here. And that is, it got its name because when they were analyzing these molecules, for every carbon, they found a water molecule. What's water? H2O. So here's a carbon, and what is bound to this carbon atom? You got H1, H2, and an O. And what's H2O? Water. So they come up with a name. Well, that's a carbohydrate. And instead of saying carbohydrate all day long, you just say carbohydrate, right? Carbohydrate. So, yeah. So because there's a carbon and it's got, okay, a water broken up and bound to it. Okay. But it's really not a water anymore. It's what? It's really a hydroxyl group, but it still confers polarity to that molecule so it can dissolve into solution. And each one of these sugars are different. All of them are 6-carbon sugars. But these are what we call simple sugars, all right? And we can combine simple sugars together. For instance, if we take a glucose and a fructose, which is this one and this one down here, and put them together, all right, we can get something called sucrose. We can put two glucoses together and get something called maltose. We can put a glucose and a galactose, which you can see from the previous slide, together, and we would call that lactose or milk sugar. All right. So anytime you see this galacto that has to do with milk, galaxy. What do galaxies look like? If you look at them, kind of white, right, like milk. Galaxies, right? That's where this name galacto comes from. Whenever you see the name of something with an OSE on the end of it right here, that means that it's a sugar. So that's just a little hint on nomenclature. All right? Lactose, that's a sugar. Maltose, that's a sugar. All right, so how do you build a little bit more complicated molecule? You take some of its building blocks. So this contains two building blocks, so we would call this a disaccharide. Sucrose, lactose, and maltose are disaccharides. That also means that then these basic building blocks are what we call monosaccharides. Okay, and we can put maybe thousands of glucoses together to form something. That's what we call a polysaccharide. And there are a couple examples of important polysaccharides. I might have this in the slide. Starch is an important polysaccharide, and glycogen are important polysaccharides. They might contain 10,000 monosaccharides, 10,000 glucose molecules, all put together into one molecule. So starch, what's the building block of starch? It is just glucose, but thousands of molecules put together in this one big mammoth molecule. So you would say the building block for a polysaccharide is a monosaccharide. Okay, and then I could ask you, well, give me an example of a monosaccharide, and you could say of a monosaccharide would be glucose, galactose, or fructose. Those are some that we're going to learn some others, like ribose. Ever hear of ribose? It's a part of probably a really important word, like DNA, RNA. stuff like that, okay? All right, so sugars play important roles in your body. So what about a trisaccharide? What's a trisaccharide? It's got three monosaccharides put together. Polysaccharide has got more than three. We kind of stopped counting after that. All right, so starch is what plants make with extra glucose. Animals don't make starch if they have extra glucose. Sometimes they make fat, but sometimes they keep it as a polysaccharide if there's extra glucose, and that's called glycogen. So our livers contain glycogen, and our muscles contain glycogen. So when our blood glucose decreases, guess where your body gets glucose from? Your liver, the glycogen in your liver. We talked about that slide already in the first chapter. All right, so glycogen, the building block of glycogen is glucose, and you typically find glycogen in liver and muscle tissue. So glycogen and starch are important energy storage molecules. Oh, let me ask you another question. What kind of food stuff has starch in it? What kind of food has starch?
Potatoes,
a lot of starch. What else?
Rice
has a lot of starch. Yeah, corn is starch, wheat is starch. So anything that's bread or looks like bread is starch. So bread, tortillas, what's another kind of bread? Pasta, for sure, is just starch. And so when you eat starch, what is it like eating?
Sugar.
It's pure sugar, exactly right. It takes a little bit longer to digest, and it's so good, I know. But, okay, it's just sugar, right? It is just plain old sugar. That's all there is to it. All right, so if somebody has trouble regulating their blood glucose levels, they got to be really concerned about the amount of starch that they eat, because it's like eating a candy bar, basically, even though it doesn't taste like it. Candy bars are even better. Okay, maybe I'll talk about this a little bit later on in the class. Okay, so here is a chemical reaction dealing with monosaccharides. Your body can take two monosaccharides like glucose, put them together to make a maltose, a disaccharide. And the way that it does that is because of these functional groups. What's this functional group right here? This is a hydroxyl group that allows the molecule to dissolve in water, but it also allows some chemical reactions to take place. So notice what's highlighted here. You have an OH group on one glucose and an H, a hydrogen, highlighted on the second glucose. And what can happen is when we form a bridge between these two glucoses to form maltose, these two things that are highlighted join together to form H2O. Right, and so now these two sugars are joined together via this oxygen bridge right here. We call this a dehydration synthesis reaction. And you see it's dehydration because what's coming out of it?
Water.
When you pull water out of something, you dehydrate it. Right, so I say dehydration synthesis. Sometimes we call that a condensation when we pull water out of something. So this is how your body makes, for instance, glycogen from many glucose molecules, a dehydration synthesis reaction. This might even be an exam figure, I'm not sure, so you got to be familiar with dehydration synthesis. And you can also take, okay, plants do this, they can take glucose and fructose. Where do you think this fruit comes from? Because it's a sugar that plants make and put in fruit. Okay, your body doesn't make much in the way of fructose, I don't think. It could probably if it wanted to. But that's the sugar that we find in fruit because it ends up in sucrose. So how does a biological system make sucrose? Sucrose is a disaccharide. The reaction is a dehydration synthesis reaction where a hydrogen from one monosaccharide is combined with an OH from a second monosaccharide, they're joined together and water is pulled out of those two reactants, so we call that a dehydration synthesis reaction. So the number of elements over here is equal to the number of elements over here. What it might be different is the energy. I don't have that on this slide. So there might be a little bit difference in energy. Okay. So when you put molecules together, it requires energy. When you break molecules apart, it releases energy. I'm going to talk about that soon. Not in this chapter, I don't think. So I think what you're looking for and you don't see here is energy. Not necessarily a carbon atom or a hydrogen or whatever. Okay? All right. All right, so going from left to right is what kind of reaction? What kind of reaction is that? Going from dehydration synthesis. And you know what? When your body wants to combine a couple building blocks together to make something a little bit more complicated, take a guess what kind of reaction that it likes to use. Dehydration synthesis reaction. So you learned a reaction, but you can apply this now to many kinds of organic compounds, like lipids, like proteins, for instance, even nucleic acids. Dehydration synthesis. And this reaction is really reversible. It can go back the other way. I don't have the arrow going back the other way. Your book doesn't have it going back the other way. But for instance, if there are special enzymes that can break maltose down into these two glucoses. But when it breaks maltose down into two glucoses, what else has to be available in order for that to happen? Water. And as a matter of fact, water has to be split apart so that the different parts of water can end up in the two different parts of maltose right here. When we break water apart, we call that hydrolysis. So when we split polymers down into their building blocks or disaccharides into two monosaccharides, we call that an hydrolysis reaction because it's also breaking water apart. All right. So this reaction can go forwards and backwards. So going from left to right, you would call that a dehydration synthesis. Going from right to left is a hydrolysis reaction. It all depends on what your physiology needs, your body will take care of. All right. So you can break down sucrose into glucose and fructose, no problem. All right. So now you know a little bit a feel for why carbohydrates are named the way they are, something about that functional group, the reactions that they undergo. That's a good starting point. A lipid is another kind of compound. Are lipids soluble in water?
No.
Now, would you expect to see a lot of carboxyl groups or a lot of hydroxyl groups on a lipid?
No,
because those confer solubility in water of those compounds. All right, so lipids are insoluble in polar solvents, like water, for instance. We call them hydrophobic because they don't like to dissolve in water. How would you talk about a chemical compound that loves to dissolve in water?
Hydrophilic,
right? Because it's a polar compound. Okay, lipids are not that way. And as a result, they consist primarily of long hydrocarbon chains or ring structures. They don't have carbonyl groups. They don't have a lot of hydroxyl groups or carboxyl groups on them. Okay, but you're going to see maybe in one location. All right. So some of you might have heard of triglycerides before if you've ever had your blood drawn and maybe glucose concentration measured or different ion concentrations measured in your blood or even the number of red blood cells. Sometimes we also measure the triglyceride concentration, the amount of fat or lipid that's being carried by your blood. And a triglyceride is made with the following building blocks. Okay, one building block is going to be a molecule called glycerol. Right, it has three carbon atoms and it's got these three hydroxyl groups. Now this here is not a lipid. How could you prove to me this is not a lipid, glycerol? Because it's got all these hydroxyl groups. It looks more like what? It looks more like a sugar. It's more related to a sugar or an alcohol than a lipid. Right? And so it is very soluble in water, but it can be used to package fatty acids. A fatty acid is a huge long hydrocarbon chain. It could have maybe 18 carbons, maybe 12 carbons, a different length. And on one end, there's going to be a carboxyl group. The carboxyl group is very reactive. It can react with the OH on glycerol. All right, the OH on glycerol can combine with this hydrogen on the carboxyl group and form water, in which case then this fatty acid will attach to the glycerol molecule. And how many positions on that glycerol molecule can a fatty acid attach to? You see, three positions, right? So three fatty acids can combine with one glycerol to form a triglyceride. And so the glyceride part comes from glycerol, and the tri right here comes from the three fatty acids. And so that kind of describes what a triglyceride is. Okay? And it is a triglyceride is produced by a dehydration synthesis reaction. All right, but if your body wants to metabolize fatty acids, for instance, for energy, it can go to a triglyceride and break it apart. What kind of chemical reaction would your body use to break a triglyceride down into three fatty acids and a glycerol molecule? A hydrolysis reaction. It's going to have to break three waters and break those bonds, and now you've broken it down to its building blocks. So let's just go back and reiterate. What's the building block of a polysaccharide?
Monosaccharide.
Could you give me a specific example of a monosaccharide? Fructose, galactose, glucose, because sucrose is really what kind of saccharide? It's a disaccharide. Okay. Now let's go to lipids so far anyway. What? Give me a specific example of a lipid. A triglyceride. What's the building block of a triglyceride? Glycerol and three fatty acids. Right. So if you want to put monosaccharides together, you have a dehydration synthesis reaction. If you put three fatty acids and a glycerol together, you have a dehydration synthesis reaction. So biology, in a lot of respects, is really simple, because once biology figures out how to do something efficiently, it doesn't have to reinvent it all the time, like a dehydration synthesis reaction. We're going to see some more examples of that even. Okay. So make sure that you know that these are fatty acids by their structure. That could possibly be on the test, what a fatty acid looks like. Know that this is a glycerol by its structure, and then this is a triglyceride. I'll help you do that in probably the next time that we meet. So a fatty acid is just a long hydrocarbon chain, so this part of the molecule is hydrophobic. And it's a little bit hydrophilic because of this carboxyl group, but it confers reactivity. It allows these molecules to combine with glycerol. Yeah.
So it will always have a
carboxyl
group on it.
A fatty acid?
Yes.
Right. And that's in the name. Fatty part of fatty acid comes from this long hydrocarbon chain, and acid comes from the carboxyl group, because the carboxyl group makes this compound acidic. Because when we put it in water, this hydrogen right here has a tendency to dissociate from the molecule. And what do we call something that donates hydrogen ions to solution? That's an acid. So that's what we call that, a fatty acid. Okay. We see two different kinds of fatty acids right here that have important meaning for us biologically. Notice that in the top one, right, this is palmitic acid, and they're just named by the number of carbons that are in there. You don't have to memorize the name. But what I want you to see on this slide is that the bonds, the covalent bonds between each carbon atom, is just a single bond. They're only sharing two electrons. Now, that doesn't have to be the case. Sometimes there can be double bonds. And if there's a double bond between carbons, then, of course, you can't have these carbons completely saturated on either side with hydrogen atoms. All right? And if that's the case, if there's a double bond, we call that an unsaturated fatty acid. So this unsaturated fatty acid on this carbon right here, there's only one hydrogen. If it was completely saturated, this double bond would have to break, and then those electrons would have to be shared with a hydrogen atom over here. So that's the essential difference between a saturated fatty acid, completely saturated with hydrogen atoms along its entire carbon backbone, and unsaturated has double bond someplace in the middle. And that double bond makes it, the molecule, change shape, and that changes the function of the molecule, changes the solubility of when it likes to melt. Okay, it can maybe give rigidity to a membrane. It also changes how it can be metabolized inside the body, and probably some of you have heard of, right, saturated versus unsaturated fatty acids, and which ones are better for you or not better for you, because they have different properties inside your body. So this is what they look like. All right, here's another kind of lipid. This one is fascinating. Okay, let's take a look. Now, when you look at this, it might not make sense. So let's take a look at this lipid right here. All right, it is built from the concept of a triglyceride. What's a triglyceride again? Glycerol and three fatty acids. All right, so let's go back to this one. This is a phospholipid. So here is that three-carbon backbone, which is glycerol, right? And we can see at the first position and second position right here, we have two fatty acids that have bound to it. What kind of reaction is going to join these long fatty acids with this glycerol right here? That's a dehydration synthesis reaction. But on the third carbon right here, I don't see a fatty acid. I see something else. I see, a phosphatidyl group. You don't have to know that. All right, but phospho means what? Phosphate. There's a phosphate group and an amino group right here. So what does this do to the ability of this molecule to dissolve in water? Now, because nitrogen produces polar kinds of covalent bonds, phosphorus produces polar kind of covalent bonds, oxygen produces polar kinds of covalent bonds. So this end of the molecule right here, with this phosphate group or phosphatidyl group, allows this end of the molecule to dissolve in water. But what about this end over here? It doesn't like to be with water. This is the hydrophobic region of the molecule, and here is the hydrophilic part of the molecule. So here's a molecule that's kind of, what I said, fascinating, because it can exist in both domains, right? The water domain as well as the oil domain in something. And your body uses, many, many more than trillions of these kinds of molecules to build something really important. So let's maybe talk about what this molecule can build. So we can take this, so I want you to not draw this out, but at least recognize this as a phospholipid for the test, all right? And we can also draw a phospholipid by this illustration right here. So this head group represents the phosphatidyl group with all these charges on it. So this is the hydrophilic portion of the molecule, and then these two legs like sticking out of it represent the long hydrophobic carbon chains that don't like to dissolve in water. All right, so this is an important molecule called a phospholipid. All right, so let's see. Over the weekend, it's a nice holiday weekend. I had a nice time. I was thinking about you guys studying and all that kind of stuff. All right, but maybe you had a party at your house and you made a nice salad with some salad dressing. All right. And in your refrigerator is a nice, what is this? I don't know who that is. Maybe ranch salad dressing, something like that. Okay. And when you look at a salad dressing bottle right in your refrigerator, it has a lot of structure associated with it. What kind of structure would you see in a salad dressing bottle right out of the refrigerator that was in there at least overnight? So here is the top. Let's just say it's a brand new bottle. But the structure is, you're going to see a line right here. And you're going to see one world up here and another world down over there. What world is floating on top of this other one? What kind of world is this? Okay, you know what? Okay, this is the oil, and this is the water down over here, H2O. So everything that is hydrophobic is going to end up here in the oil, and down here in the water is going to be all the chemicals that are hydrophilic. Like, for instance, sodium. Where's that going to end up? That's going to end up down here. All right. Now, the interesting question is, did you have to pay somebody, or did you have to do something special to get these two worlds to develop inside your refrigerator, or did it happen automatically? That's kind of hard to imagine, that it happens automatically, but you know what? It just does. Because of the natures of these molecules separate out from each other. All right? So sodium goes over here. What else would go down over here? What other kind of molecule that we just looked at? Sugars, spices and things like over would go down into the water because they're polar compounds. All the oils up over here. And of course, before you pour this on your salad, what do you want to do? You want to shake it up, unless you just want oil on your salad. Okay? You want some of the good spices and stuff too, right? All right, now let's take this phospholipid and put one phospholipid molecule in the salad dressing bottle. And the question is it going to end up in the oil, or is it going to end up down here in the water? It's going to be in a really special place. Yeah, you had a question?
I was
you were saying up or down. Okay. Well, you know what? It's neither going to be up in the oil or down here in the water. It's going to be exactly right smack in the middle. And guess what? You don't have to do anything special to get it there. So what part is going to go down in the water over here? That's going to be this polar head group. All right, so here it is. Right here. Here's the head group. And what's sticking up into the oil? The tails are sticking up into the oil like that. Did you have to do anything special to that? Just automatically, it finds its way there by the nature of that molecule. All right, but now if we don't put just one molecule in, let's put like 1,000 phospholipids in there, what's going to happen? It's going to form this kind of structure just like this. Now, what does that kind of look like to you? That looks like a membrane. All right, and did you have to do anything special to build that membrane? No, the only thing you had to do is build that molecule. Membranes form automatically by themselves. That's a basic structural feature of life. It builds itself automatically, which is kind of fascinating, right? Life has a tendency just to build itself out of the natural processes, the physical chemistry of the universe. All right, so another way, another example is this right here. If we put a bunch of, so what are these molecules here? These are all phospholipids. If we put thousands, or if we take this salad bowl right here, shake it up, destroy the system, all right, this nice linear system, these phospholipids are going to form spheres, which we call micelles, and I think you can appreciate why they form just spontaneously, right? These hydrophobic tails are going to point to the inside of the sphere because they don't want to be by water, and the hydrophilic head groups are going to want to be by water, so they're going to stick to the outside of the micelle. So that forms a membrane, and if you look at this thing, what does it kind of remind you of? To me, that reminds me of a cell. So cells have a tendency to just automatically build themselves out of the proper kinds of chemicals, right, the proper building blocks. So that's kind of a take-home message, and that is the basic building block of a cell membrane is a phospholipid. Okay, so the basic building block of a cell membrane is a phospholipid. You're going to see that the arrangement is a little bit more complicated than this micelle right here, but it's a really close approximation of a cell membrane. All right, so who doesn't see why these molecules line up just like that? I think everybody should have kind of a feel for why they line up just like that, just because of the nature of these two different parts of the molecule. And this I'm going to talk about a little bit later. All right, let's move on to another kind of lipid. So these things that are hydrocarbon ring structures, I don't see any OH groups. I maybe see one, right, or a carbonyl group right here, but not very dominant. And here, these are just long hydrocarbon chains. This is another nonpolar kind of compound. Doesn't necessarily like to dissolve in water. Whenever you see something that has this nice stairs, that kind of looks like a staircase or steps going up, that's going to be a steroid of some kind, which is a lipid. Right, non-soluble in water. This one right here is cholesterol. And what can you tell me about cholesterol? Good or bad to have in your body? Ooh, good, bad, okay. You're exactly right. It's good and bad. Okay? It's bad because if you have too much, it can cause atherosclerosis or disease in blood vessels. But cholesterol is the precursor or progenitor molecule that makes cortisol, an important hormone in your body. Testosterone, another important hormone in your body. What kind of hormone is that? Oh, yeah, it's a male sex hormone is what I was trying to get at. And this estradiol is a female sex hormone. You guys are shy, so I'm trying to get you over your shyness a little bit. So, yes, you have to have some cholesterol to make these various other kinds of hormones in your body. All right, and these are all lipid-soluble, not water-soluble. And I think I use this as an example for a control experiment. For instance, if maybe we want to maybe help pregnancy in an individual, and maybe estrogen might be proposed to help maybe becoming pregnant or maintaining pregnancy or something, or maybe supra-ovulating somebody for an in vitro fertilization process or something like that. So we might need to use some of these steroid hormones or related compounds that are very similar to each other. How do we dissolve that estradiol so that we can give somebody a shot of that? Can we dissolve it in water?
No.
It has to be oil, for instance, right? And that's not a very comfortable kind of shot to get, unfortunately, but that just kind of underscores And don't forget that oil has estrogenic properties all by itself. So if you really want to understand the properties of estrogen, your control group has to get a shot of oil without that estrogen, right? Okay. All right, so make sure that you can tell me that all of these different molecules, you don't have to tell me specifically estradiol, but you should be able to tell me that that's a lipid and a steroid of some kind, okay, by its shape. I don't see a lot of hydroxyl groups on it. Here's another kind of lipid. You can see that it's a fatty acid that has a nice hairpin loop on it. And these are prostaglandins. All of these are prostaglandins. These are important signaling molecules or regulatory molecules in your body. They're derived from fatty acids. So if you see this nice hairpin or paperclip kind of shape, you're going to say, well, it's a prostaglandin kind of molecule, important for regulation. All right, so we're done with carbohydrates, lipids. That takes us to proteins. And, okay, protein, what's a building block for a protein? Amino acid, that's right. Okay, so that's a building block for protein. And this is what amino acids look like. So I want you to be able to recognize this thing right here. I don't want you to say, oh, that's a monosaccharide. Does that look like a monosaccharide to you? I hope look at it a bunch so that you can say, oh yeah, that's not a monosaccharide. Right? If you look at this thing, would you say that's a steroid? All right? You should be able to say no. You should be able to have a picture in your mind. Or a prostaglandin, you would say no. Triglyceride? Obviously not. Okay? This thing is an amino acid. Now, why is it an amino acid? What do we call amino acid? Well, what is this carboxyl group right here? That's an acid group, right? Because that hydrogen can be donated to solution. That's an acid. This NH2, that's one of the functional groups that I am asking you to memorize from the previous slide. That's an amino group. All right, so if you combine amino with acid, you get amino acid. So a lot of this isn't really too complicated, but you still have to develop a little bit of an eye for it. All right, there is a central carbon right here that has the carboxyl group attached to it and the amino group. There is one hydrogen, which isn't too significant, but the fourth bond right here, we see that it is covalently bound to R. And what R means is that it's a highly variable group. It could be a number of different things. It could be just a simple hydrogen ion, or it could be a methyl group, which is a CH3, or it could be an OH group. Right, it could have a lot of variability. So, for instance, I only see hydrocarbons right here. This amino acid is valine. You don't have to know the names of amino acids. I just want you to know that, that is an amino acid of some kind. Right? So here is that variable group, and you can see that, is this polar or nonpolar? It's just, do you see any OHs? Do you see any nitrogens? Do you see any phosphates on there? It's just a hydrocarbon side chain, so this means that this part is nonpolar. It's going to have a tendency to want to be around other nonpolar molecules and not really associate with water because of its structure. Here is another hydrocarbon ring, right? There's one OH right here, but basically this is a nice nonpolar hydrocarbon structure. So when we change the structure in this variable region on an amino acid, okay, we change the chemical properties of it and the physiologic properties of it as well. We're going to see how that happens. Other kinds of amino acids, right, because they have nitrogen groups, they can be basic in nature. Here's one that has a carboxyl group. That means that this amino acid is even more acidic, right, because of that carboxyl group. That also means this amino acid dissolves very easily in water, or this end of it dissolves easily in water. And here's one that has an SH group. Again, that makes it dissolve in water very easily. So there are 20 different kinds of amino acids, major ones in your body. They all have different R groups on them. So that means that when we start to put amino acids together, we can change, remember, because amino acid is the building block of a protein, we can build proteins with millions of different kinds of functions, depending on how that protein is put together with different amino acids, because different amino acids have different structures. So the complexity with proteins is almost unlimited because of the nature of these side groups. That's not really so with polysaccharides because it's really the same molecule over and over and over again. But proteins have a lot of complexity because there's complexity in the side groups that can be added to the molecule. All right? And if we want to put, and we're going to close after this question, if we want to put a couple amino acids together, guess what kind of reaction we use? Dehydration synthesis reaction. We have an OH group on one amino acid and an H on the next, and we can pull out a water and form a nice peptide bond right there via that dehydration synthesis reaction. Many times over, so this would be a nice polysaccharide. Or actually, this would not a saccharide. This would be a polypeptide with these three amino acids. It's going to pull out three waters. And if you want to break this polypeptide down, what kind of reaction would your body use? A hydrolysis reaction. Okay? So the same reaction over and over and over again. All right, so that's it for today. What's really important is you start to work with your study guide, exam study guide. Chapter 1 is on Blackboard. And start answering the questions that are on the web, labeling the questions at the end of the book, and you'll be in really good shape for the test. Maybe get together and study with somebody so that you can ask each other questions. Never leave lab early because you can work with each other in lab. And you can pester your lab instructor, which they love. I'm going to turn my microphone off before I say somebody's name.